Hello and welcome to episode 182 of Page One, the Writer's Podcast. I'm Marco.
And I'm Tarek.
And we're back after a very long time.
What a beat.
I was sort of back.
You were back.
With Page One Extra episode, but you couldn't be bothered turning up for that one.
I was sleeping. Could be getting up for that one, yeah.
Well, indeed, yeah. It was nice to get emails and Twitter messages and stuff from people saying, where are you, when you're coming back, and all this sort of...
We even
got one that was sort of like, I hope everything's okay, which was very nice, thank you for that.
It's always nice to know that actually people are listening to the show, and not just us and my mum.
exactly. but we did have a reasonable... I mean, part of it is just sheer laziness, but also, you know, you had the minor... thing of having another child, and
yeah, that really crimped my style, I have to say. Yeah.
And I was busy trying to write a draft of this novel, so yeah, we have been up to stuff, but we are now back, and we have some great episodes lined up.
We do have some great episodes. I have to say though, I just said crimped my style. Should it be cramped my style?
Yes,
it's cramped, isn't it? Cramped is that kind of like pattern you make of something.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I'm going to keep that in.
So. No, that's fine. It did also crimp my style. I'm now made of...
Maybe it did. Maybe you're wearing some... I've not seen your clothes. yes, but we have a number of good episodes lined up. We're both with industry people, as we call them, you know, agents, editors, things like that coming up. But starting today, we have a great new debut author. But actually also... plays into the industry people as well, because he's
the best
got
a foot
in both
worlds.
Camps.
We're chatting with the wonderful James Logan, who is also known by his day job title James Long. So as Mr. Long, when he puts his long cap on, he is an editor at Orbit, a senior commissioning editor at Orbit. And when he puts on his Logan cap, he is a writer of The Silver Blood Promise, which is his debut novel coming out quite soon.
Yeah, a fantasy novel that's, as we chat about, very much in the vein of regular listeners will know, one of my favourite novels, Lieselotte Lamora, and we talk about how excited he was to get a quote from Scott Lynch himself about his novel. And we also hear about his long journey to publication as well, which looked like it might not even happen at one point. So, really interesting chat, and obviously interesting to hear from someone that works on the other side of the fence, if you like.
Yeah. And it's one of these things where I think people often think, you know, oh, you're an editor at a publishing house, that must make it easy for you to get your book out there, or, you know, you know all the hints and tricks, you've got
just commission it yourself.
Yes, that's right. Oh, by myself, got a massive
I've just got this new manuscript from a guy called James Logan.
It sounds like James Long. It looks similar. It's definitely not me.
Exactly. But that is not what happened, as we will hear. So, so we will get straight into it after our advert, which I'm sure you've all missed, for our notebooks. we will be back at the end of the podcast with a bit more chat and to let you know about next week's guest.
But for now, on with the podcast.
The blank page. To some, it's terrifying, an obstacle to overcome. But we prefer to think of it as an opportunity, a blank canvas to be filled with all of the adventures and characters in our head. So how to overcome that fear? Well, we all know the best advice for a writer is, write. Seriously, get words on the page and more will follow.
But what about later, when you start trying to pull those threads of what you've written together? What about the character you wrote about way back at the start? Who was she again? What was she carrying? And where did she leave the MacGuffin that she now really needs in the third act? Think about all those top thrillers you like to read. Or that amazing drama you just watched. What did they all have in common? Structure and planning.
As aspiring writers ourselves, we've tried many different methods to try and organise all the thoughts about the stories we want to tell. We've been there, searching for a piece of scrap paper to note something down, or making a quick note on our phone in between meetings.
Or sometimes we'll make a note in whatever notebook we're carrying, or a document on our laptop so we don't forget that great idea. Let's be honest, it can all be a bit messy and it's easy to lose track of everything. And that's when we realise It's not just the story that needs structure and planning, but the way we gather all of our thoughts about it as well.
And so we made Page One. Page One is more than just another notebook. It's a place to put down all your ideas for your latest project, divided into easy-to-use sections that will help you plan your story, so that when that blank page comes calling, you're ready to answer. And then afterwards, once it's written, we realised you need to plan how to let people read it, so we included a section relating to submissions.
Each one is designed for one project, whether you want to write a book, screenplay, a comic, or any other kind of story. We truly believe that when you use it, it will help you get to the main event, writing your story. So we hope this helps.
We can't wait to read what you come up with.
And remember, every story starts with Page One.
As you know, as a regular listener, my starting question is often, did you always want to be a writer? And I will start with that. But obviously you have had a gamut of jobs in and around writing, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, that's right. I've been working in publishing since 2010. So I've been actually in the industry for about 14 years, I suppose. And it's funny because I remember being at that school in like a music lesson, I think, and just not obviously wasn't paying attention, but I remember thinking, I think I was reading, what was it? Was I reading Wheel of Time at that time? I can't remember, but I remember thinking, oh, it'd be really cool to like work in publishing, work with books, and it'd be really cool to work for Orbit. And then, you know, funnily enough, many years later, I did actually work for Orbit. So, that sort of came much later. And, to answer your question, I didn't actually start out wanting to be a writer. I think the first thing I remember wanting to be with any real conviction was a Teenage Mutant Hero Turtle, probably when I was about five. And needless to say, that was a crushing disappointment when it didn't happen. But I think when you're a kid, when you think about what you might do, it's such a strange concept at that point, because you're so young, you don't really understand the world or, you know, careers or anything like that. But you kind of, yeah. I suppose you think about it in terms of what you enjoy doing. And so my kind of loves around that time were sort of books, books may be my first love, but also computer games and football and music. And it never occurred to me that I could be a writer. And obviously video games were just in their infancy at that moment in time. Now, the industry is nothing like it is now. I did think about being a footballer, but I had the kind of obstacle to overcome of actually not being very good at the sport. So that was a bit of a problem.
I know that one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I sort of latched onto music, and music became my kind of real obsession when I was a teenager. And that's what I wanted to do. I decided I wanted to be a musician. And when I say musician, what I really mean is international rock star, yeah, you know. And I believed it with a conviction that you only really have as a teenager, you know. You're absolutely convinced that this is going to happen. It's a matter of when, not if. And you know, and for sort of 2 or 3 years, like my sort of when I was a teenager, I kind of lived that dream. And I played in the band with some friends, and we, you know, did gigs and made recordings and generally had a really, really great time. It was a real creative outlet for me. I sort of wrote most of the music, and I wrote the lyrics. Lyrics are terrible, terrible lyrics, but you know, that's where it started for me, was kind of writing song lyrics. I did that for a while, and then I think I was around 17 and going to sixth form college. And I think it was around that point when you're a bit older and the little bubble that you realize you've been living in sort of just bursts and reality kind of pours in a little bit. And I kind of realized that far from sort of, you know, being able to just go out on some kind of massive world tour and make millions of pounds, I was actually going to have to go to university. So reality kind of dawned in quite a brutal way. And I think by that point I was starting to get a bit tired of the band anyway, like, you know, too many gigs, kind of sitting around waiting like 5 hours between the sound check and the actual gig, you know. And this was in the 90s. It was before mobile phones and you know, iPads and everything, so it wasn't really an easy way of killing the time. So it just became a bit tedious, and I think I just kind of fell out of love with it a little bit, and also realized it just wasn't going to happen for me in the way I thought. So yeah, so it was around that time I ditched the band and traded sort of Friday night rehearsals for working in Sainsbury's home base, which was every bit as thrilling as it sounds. But yeah, it was around that. This is all a very long-winded way of saying that it was around that time that I started writing. And it wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't like I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm no longer in the band doing that creative thing, so I need to find something else. But I think looking back at it now, I think it was a subconscious thing. I think I've always had like a creative outlet. I've always had a need to kind of do something creative. And when I was very young, it was drawing. I would draw a huge amount, which is ironic because today I'm absolutely appalling at drawing. But that's what I did when I was young. And then when I was a bit older, it was music, as I've said. I was really into the music. And I think once that went, I think my subconscious was kind of to some extent being like, oh, we need to find something else to kind of throw our creative energy into. So even if I didn't realize it at the time, I think that's what happened. So I sort of latched onto the writing. And there was some crossover. I remember thinking, because I'd always been a huge reader, went to, you know, library every week as a kid, and sort of read voraciously. And I think the first thing I read was... the first thing kind of fantastical thing that I remember reading was the Tim and the Hidden People series by Sheila McCullough, who's a British writer and not nearly as well known, I think, as she should be. But that series, which was kind of like quite common in British schools in the 80s, I think, as kind of a reading series, that series, which had amazing illustrations, was just really imaginative and incredibly atmospheric. And I just remember, because my mother was a teacher, so she had the full set in the classroom. And I just remember sitting there being like, completely gripped by the series. And that was, I think that was the earliest I remember, like the fantastical, just kind of really gripping me and fixating on it. So that's kind of where it started. And then we had in those days, like the Puffin Book Club. I don't even know if that's still a thing, but you know, you get at the end of the school day, you'd get your, every so often you get your little catalog with all the books in it, and you would kind of go away and look at it and then come back and order something. And then like 2 weeks later, they would arrive. It was always quite exciting. And there was one time there was one of the books included in the catalog was the fighting fantasy game book called Return to Firetop Mountain. And I had no idea the series even existed, but it was huge in the 80s. It was a real publishing phenomenon, sold millions of copies. And by the time I came to it in kind of the mid-90s, it was already starting to wind down because the audience was starting to gravitate towards video games and stuff. So it was kind of slowly sort of, you know, dying a slow, prolonged death. But I don't know why, but I looked at that book and for some reason I decided I wanted it. And I bought it and... that was it. That was pretty much it for me. I just instantly was hooked, and like, you know, this fantastical world where I could be the hero, and you know, and the illustrations again were by Martin McKenna, were just phenomenal, brilliant illustrations. And so that was the second thing that's really hooked me in, and that was kind of it for me. I just spent many afternoons sort of rolling dice and adventuring in this world, and sort of devoured the other books, and that's where my love of fantasy grew. And from there, I kind of eventually sort of gravitated towards like Brian Jack's Ripple series, and then from on from that to kind of adult authors like, you know, Terry Brooks, sort of Shannara and Robert Jordan with The Wheel of Time, and kind of, you know, all those big fantasy epics, which were mostly written by men in those days. So that's kind of, you know, that was my path kind of into it, and sort of never left it. So while all the time I was in the band, I was reading these books. I was really kind of still just obsessed with kind of fantasy and so on. And so it meant that when the music stopped, and I just decided that maybe I could write a book, you know, and I'd already had all these years of being immersed in those kind of worlds to draw on. And so it just seemed like a natural thing for me to do. And so I just literally, I had no idea what I was doing, of course, but I feel like that's almost the best way of doing it. I just literally just kind of opened the word processor and wrote chapter one and started typing. And I didn't have the faintest idea what I was doing. I knew nothing about plot or character or structure or pacing or anything. I just had that same kind of, the same confidence that made me think I could be a rock star I had with the writing. I just kind of assumed that I could do it. And I vividly remember telling my friend, like in his kitchen, just like random memory of being in his kitchen, just saying to him, oh, I bet I could write a fantasy book. You know, just like cocky sort of teenager way. But I think that's what gave me the confidence to actually do it. And so that's kind of where it started. I started writing, and this was around when I was at sixth form college, and we live around the corner from the college. And so unlike many of my kind of peers who like had to travel in and then hang around college all day waiting for a 4 p.m. lecture or whatever, I could sort of go home in between lessons, you know. So it meant that I spent quite a lot of time at home just on my own and had loads of time to write. And so that's kind of where I sort of, I guess I cut my teeth sort of, that's kind of where it began, I suppose, for me in terms of the writing.
Yeah. Funny, fighting fantasy, just going back to them briefly, I was very much into those as a kid as well. And my favorite was the, did you play the City of Thieves one?
Oh yeah. I should say I have the entire set.
Yeah. I was just looking on my bookshelves there because I have several there. I was going to try and find
I've got the whole load. Yeah.
I think I'm the same as you, James. I came to them in the kind of 90s, and they were definitely dying, that kind of slow death part. And I definitely remember reading a few of them and loving them, but they were not anywhere near as big, I think, as they had been 10, 15 years
before. Yeah, they weren't. And because they're becoming less popular, the later ones had much smaller print runs. And as a result, they're far more valuable.
Yeah, they are.
You go on eBay and like, they're exchanging hands for, you know, when I was doing it, I was about 20 years ago or so that I decided I wanted to complete my collection. And at that point, some of the later ones were going for like 60, 70 quid. Mm. I have no idea what they are now, but yeah, it was a lot of fun playing those.
So you started, you know, you thought, right, I'll just bang out a fantasy book and started, and you had no, and it was just, it sounds like there was no real plan. You didn't have a plan or anything. You just sort of started writing and see.
Was
that The Flames of Hope? Is that the one that you were writing?
It was. I mentioned it in my biography, I think, didn't I? On the website. Is that where you saw that? I probably regret mentioning that now, but yeah,
we have a copy here. No, we don't.
Oh gosh. Well, I should hope not. I've got the only copy of that. So I still do have the actual original copy of those chapters. But yeah, it was the Flames of Hope, which. It's kind of pretentious, but you know, not a million miles away from probably a half decent title. But I just started writing, and I think like many sort of young inexperienced writers, what I did was just I was just kind of mainlining the sort of stuff I enjoyed reading. So it was all these big classic tropes of like, you know, farm boys realizing they have, you know, secret heritage and dark lords and wizards that kind of know a lot more than they're letting on. You know, all those really classic high fantasy tropes. Yeah. And I was just kind of throwing them down on the page with no idea what I was doing. And it wasn't bad. I've still got the original chapters, and like you read them back now, and like obviously it's very kind of raw and kind of a bit wooden in places, but you can see there's something there. It's not completely abysmal, but it was incredibly derivative. And it just after a while it just kind of ran out of steam or whatever, and I think I started writing something else which is very similar but slightly different. And this would start a pattern over the next sort of 12 months of just starting new projects and then just abandoning them. And that just kind of happened over and over again. Sort of university time came around, and like a lot of people on this podcast have admitted, I didn't get a whole lot of writing done at university. And I'd love to say that was because I was, you know, living the high life or whatever and partying all the time, but it was really just because I was locked in my dormitory playing video games. But you know, there was a vague attempt at a novel in the third year, and I think I scrapped that after about 15,000 words or something. Then I went away and did a master's, and I don't think there was any writing during that time. Although I did start writing short stories, and I think this was the result. This is like a horrendous name drop, which I have no right to do, but I emailed George R. R. Martin, and this was back when he was like big but not super famous like he is now, and he still actually had the time to respond to emails. So I emailed him, and I was, you know, classic kind of like, oh, you know, I want to be a writer, and can you give me any advice or whatever? And he replied, and I've still got the email printed out actually, but he replied, and he said, start with short stories, because you need to learn the act of like the three-act structure, and you need to learn how to finish something. And it's actually really, really good advice. During my master's, I kind of dipped into short fiction and wrote a few stories. And weirdly, it was horror that I wrote, even though I have no grounding in horror whatsoever. For some reason, I just found that lent itself quite well to short fiction. So wrote a few horror stories, and I sold a couple of them to like this sort of fledgling magazine. I think it was called Lighthouse Magazine. And it was a very small kind of small magazine, I think, in based in like Newcastle or something or other. And they bought a couple of my stories. And so I kind of felt some kind of vindication, because I remember Stephen King kind of saying, you know, if you have sold a story and the check didn't bounce, then I consider you to have a degree of talent, you know. So I kind of clung to that and kind of thought, well, someone paid me a tenner for the story, so I must be good. But it was then in the years that followed that I kind of this cycle continued for a long time. The kind of, I'd start a novel and then I would kind of abandon it. And by this point, I was kind of trying to make my way into the world of work. And like a lot of people, didn't really have a clue what I wanted to do, and just sort of ended up in this really quite sort of soul destroying corporate kind of office job. And the writing sort of went from being a sort of a passion to being an escape, I suppose, you know, something to kind of focus on and cling to. And I always had this belief that, you know, one day I was going to write a book. And, and it's like, you know, so I would start a project and then end it, and that just cycle continued and went on and on. And then I think it was around, yeah, it was I then moved back to the southeast to start the start working for Orbit, and it was it was about 2015. I think I stopped writing when I sort of entered publishing, because it just felt kind of weird for a while, like the idea of like writing a novel while I was actually in, you know, being an editorial assistant and actually working in the industry. There's something about it that just felt quite odd. And then sort of I learned like years later that like everyone's doing it. Like half the people that work in publishing are also writing a novel on the sly, even if they don't admit it. So everyone's at it. So I wasn't unique by any stretch of the imagination. But I think it got to about 2015, and I think there was like one abandoned attempt before that at some point. I got about halfway through, but in, you know, again, I didn't finish what I started, and that's something that I'll come back to actually, because I think it's worth talking about. But it was 2015 when I think I finally just thought to myself, I need to actually do this now. I've been talking about doing it, and I've been thinking about doing it for like the better part of like 15, 20 years at this point. And I just, you know, I think we all know people that have, you know, that talk a good game but never actually deliver. And I didn't want to be one of those people that always talked about doing something but didn't actually do it. I actually wanted to do it. And I just decided that, you know, I have to do this now. I actually have to sit down and stop just talking about it and actually do it. And so January 2015 was when I sat down and started writing the first chapter of what would become The Silver Blood Promise. And that took, many years later, it became The Silver Blood Promise. It was about 6 or 7 years it took in total to actually write that novel. Mm-hmm. So, it was just a case of kind of, you know, I suppose the time just felt right, and I felt like I was finally in a position where, you know, I needed to see it through. So that was how that eventually came about.
Well, I mean, you've got like, you know, so you've written Silver Blood Promise, and yeah, it took you 6-7 years to finish, but this is the first book you've written from and actually finished.
How did that
compare to your previous stuff, like Flames of Hope, for example?
And
why did you finish it, you think, I suppose, is the question.
Yeah, so this was the thing, and this is where, you know, coming back to this, I think one of the, there's not much writing advice out there that I think is genuinely worth listening to, but one of the pieces that I do think is worth listening to is the suggestion that you really should try and finish what you start. And that's advice that I really wish I had kind of taken on board much earlier, because, you know, all of these times of you know, starting a project and then abandoning it, I got really, really good at writing the first quarters of novels, but I had no practice at writing in the rest of it, you know. So I had no idea. So the reason Silver Blood took me so long to write was because it took me 3 years for the first draft. And I remember knocking out 100,000 words in the first year and thinking, oh, this is great. Like another 6 months, I'll have another 50,000 words and I'll be done. Apart from I only then wrote 50,000 words in the whole of the second year. And I realized then that I still had probably another 50,000 to go. And I only did 50,000 in the third year. So I finally finished after 3 years, finally crawled over the line at 200,000, limped over the line at 200,000 words. So it took three years and 200,000 words to kind of do that first draft. And then it took another 2 or 3 years to refine it. But yeah, I mean, I think the reason it took so long was just because I didn't know my process at all. I just didn't really know. I had some craft because I'd been writing for years by this point. So I had some craft and I understood kind of the basics and I had a handle on them. And you know, my writing was reasonably good at this point. But I had no idea how to actually write a novel. I had no idea what my own process was. I had no idea to kind of how to deal with it when the kind of going got really difficult. And so effectively writing the book was me learning how to write, or how I write. And I think that's something, that's the other bit of advice that I think is worth listening to. I think, you know, when you know, writers kind of say you have to find out what works for you, I think that's incredibly true, because we all work so differently. Like my partner is a writer, and she just works completely differently to how I do. She'll just like jump around all over the place. Like she'll start on chapter one and then go to chapter 10 and then go back to chapter 4 or whatever. And I just can't, my brain doesn't work like that. I wrote the whole of Silver Blood chronologically. And the second book that I'm on at the moment, I'm pretty much doing the same. And the one time that I had to kind of jump around a bit, because I was stuck on one bit, but I knew a later bit how it went. So I was like, I'll just jump ahead to that. And that was fine. But the trouble is, I then realized when I went back to fill in, you know, when it all kind of came out in the wash, I realized that I'd introduced inconsistencies because I'd written it out of order. And it took time to straighten out. And I just thought, oh my God, I can't be doing with that. You know, so my brain just works chronologically. But yeah, it's, I think, you know, ideally what you would do when, you know, when you're writing and for the first time, you'll write something from start to finish, and then you'll do it again and you'll do it again, and you'll learn your process. But because I wasn't finishing things, I wasn't given the chance to learn my own process. And so as a result, Silver Blood was quite a struggle at times because I just didn't really know what I was doing. And, you know, like I would try and do the thing where you write every day because that's what authors say you should do. It didn't work for me. I just burned out really quickly and just came to really resent, you know, the whole act of writing, which is terrible if you're trying to write a book. So it was a case of learning what worked for me and just trying to kind of hone that process. Once I had the first draft, it then took sort of another 2 or 3 years of rewrites and things because I had I kind of winged it, really, to be honest. Like, you know, if we're talking kind of the whole Panzer plotter kind of thing, I started writing it and I had an idea for about the first third. I had a rough idea of how it would work, and I was like, it's fine, like, you know, I'll get there and then I'll just figure it out. And then I didn't, you know, so I had to kind of stop and just take like a whole month to just kind of figure out how the rest of the book worked. And then a year later, I had to do the same to kind of figure out the final act again. So I kind of did come into it like without really a cohesive plan. And that was definitely a mistake. I'm definitely someone that needs a really solid idea of what I'm doing. I don't need to know every single thing. I don't need to know every single detail, but I need to know the main structure. Yeah. So I think for me, like, trying to strike a balance between knowing enough so that I don't get lost, but also leaving enough kind of wiggle room to actually allow the story to develop organically, because some of the best stuff I find is stuff that happens that you're not expecting, and you'll just be writing and suddenly you'll think, what about this? And then it's important to have the room, I think, to let those kind of things grow. And if you're writing like with too kind of solid a plan, it can strangle the actual story a bit at times. Yeah. So, you know,
I think that's right. I mean, I'm like you, I do like to have a plan. Sometimes, you know, I can start something, you know, but I won't get very far into it before I think, right, how does this, you know, and then I have to have some sort of plan. But you're right, a lot of the good stuff does come in the writing. So you want like a skeletal plan, I think, is the best thing, you know, and then you can let the bones of it come out in the writing. And sometimes things will change and that you didn't expect, but I always like having that security blanket of, right, okay, where am I trying to get to at least? And then you can try and work things out that way.
Yeah, I mean, I just hear these horror stories of authors like, you just kind of, you know, pantsers who just kind of sit down and write. And I just couldn't do it. But like, and they'll just be kind of like, yeah, you know, I have to write like 300,000 words to get the 150,000 words that I need. Exactly, and I just think, oh, it just makes my toes curl. I just can't even begin to imagine doing that. I just, you know, but with the second book I'm writing at the moment, I think I've only, I've stuck pretty closely to the plan. I think there's one chapter I've realized I need to rewrite, but, you know, when all is said and done, I think I'll only be tossing out about sort of 10,000 words from this first draft, you know, which is how I like to work. I like to try to not have too much wastage. I like to kind of have a good solid idea of, like, you know, what I'm doing, just to avoid that, I think.
Does that mean as well that when you're doing that first draft, because I think Tarek is a fan of the phrase the vomit draft, he likes to get it down and then revise it. Whereas I'm definitely more revise as I go. Like, if something isn't working, I feel I need to fix it before I can move on, kind of.
You see, I used to be like that. I used to have a real, one of the things, you know, when we're talking about learning your own process, one of the things I had to learn was I had to wean myself off being a perfectionist, because I have like quite perfectionist traits. And one of the really terrible habits I got into, like, over the years when I was kind of trying to write, you know, manuscripts, I would kind of, it had to be perfect before I moved on to the next bit, you know. So like, I do a chapter and I couldn't move on until I knew that the first chapter was great, you know. And so I'd go over it and over it and over it, and all that did was kill any momentum that you have, and it also just kills your excitement for what you're writing, because you're just going over it over and over again. And all that happens is you end up with a really super polished first chapter, but then you just have no kind of momentum going into the next one, and you just kind of then get stuck. And that was something I very much had to you sort of unlearn. And I remember like writing Silver Blood and like writing a paragraph that I knew wasn't quite right. And my urge was to go back and to mess with it. And I just thought, no, I have to just let it go and keep going. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but for me, that was really hard to do. It went kind of against all my natural instincts. And so I very much had to sort of form those new neural pathways, like in terms of how I thought about it. It's like really, you know, literally retrain my brain to not think like that and to think differently. And it was hard work, but now I'm very much kind of in agreement with Tarek that the first draft now, because something that's interesting for me writing the second book is, like, I'm kind of, you know, doing this now, like, with doing it properly, so to speak. You know, the first book was just kind of a mess of trying to learn on the hoof, as it were, and figure out as I went. Whereas this, I'm very much, I have my craft down, I know my process, and this is the first time I'm writing a book kind of, you know, really sort of in the driving seat, knowing exactly what I'm doing. And it's definitely been far, far easier. But it's also, I do treat the first draft, even though I write what I think are quite polished first drafts, nonetheless, it is very much a kind of get it down. Don't really worry too much about if it's not quite right. Just get flesh it out, get the ideas down, get the structure down. Don't worry about the finer details. I think I find it easier to just not kind of fixate on those during the first draft. And you end up with first drafts full of like placeholder names, and sometimes just, you know, XXX said to YYY. And, and that drives me mad sometimes, but it's better than stopping and spending 15 minutes trying to think of a good name. The downside is that some of these placeholder names just end up never getting replaced. And even now, I'll sort of be flicking through Silverblood and I'll be like, oh, that's a crap name. Why didn't I change it? You know, but you kind of become blind to it, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, when we had Joe Abercrombie on, he said that, you know, sometimes when he's in the description part of a, you know, has to write something descriptive, that can bog him down. So sometimes he'll literally just write description here and then move on to the next bit.
Yeah.
And he'll deal with that in the next draft.
Absolutely.
He's just thinking about that.
Yeah. It's I mean, there are, you do bump into things that kind of just take longer, and sometimes it does make sense to just kind of gloss over.
Yeah.
I don't like to leave gaps if I can avoid it, but I try and get something down. But if I write a paragraph and I know it's not right, I'll just highlight it and leave a comment saying, you idiot, you know, sort this out or whatever. And then it's a problem for future me down the line, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, we've chatted kind of around and about Silverblood, promise, but why don't you tell us what it's actually about?
The book is about, I suppose the book is kind of, what I was trying to do with it was write my kind of love letter to fantasy, really. I just wanted to write a book that it just encompassed everything that I enjoy seeing in kind of fantasy fiction, and which I wasn't really seeing enough of in sort of my day job as an editor, as a commissioning editor. You know, I just wasn't seeing this kind of fantasy. And when I say this kind of fantasy, what I mean is kind of, you know, I really enjoy, like, you know, Joe Abercrombie, Scott Lynch, Jay Kristoff, these kind of like epic fantasies. I'm just not seeing like a huge amount of them, either coming into me or just generally being published. And so it was, the view I kind of took was almost like, well, you know, if no one else is going to do it, then I will try and do it. So I was just writing what I really enjoy reading, and throwing all the kind of stuff in there that I love to see. But really the book is about, it's about a young kind of lapsed aristocrat called Lucan Gardova, who has fallen out with his father and become estranged from his father. And he's been kicked out of the academy after a duel he was involved in went very wrong. And he's kind of been sort of not on the run since then, but just sort of traveling about and just getting into trouble and just, you know, drinking too much and playing and gambling too much and that kind of thing. And just generally trying to figure out, like, what do I do now? Because I've made a mess of everything. And then he learns that his father has been murdered, and, you know, under very strange circumstances. But before he died, his father left a message for him written in his own blood. And there were three words that he wrote down. And the first word was Lucan. So presumably the message was meant for Lucan. The second word was, my God, you know what? I've forgotten, actually. This is terrible. What was the second word? The second word was Sophrona. And Sophrona is a kind of a fabled city of merchant princes at the far southern end of the continent, where Lucan has never been. And as far as he knows, his father has never had any connection to that city. So he's not quite sure why his father would write that. And then the third word that his father wrote was Zandrusa. And Lucan has absolutely no idea who or what Zandrusa is. But it seems pretty apparent to him that if he's, you know, there's a message here, he needs to figure out why his father wrote these words. And the obvious thing to do is to go to Sophrona and try and see if he can learn what Zandrusa means. Hoping that will shed some light on what happened to his father and who killed him and why. And so really that's the jump off point for the story and the wider series. And so in Silverblood, Lucan goes to Sophrona. And basically the more he digs into this kind of mystery, the more you know, he gets himself in trouble, and he eventually gets tangled up in this kind of conspiracy that kind of threatens to send the whole city spiraling into war. But like, it's just, I hope it's just, it's full of, you know, just action and intrigue. And I as I said, I just try to put it, you know, pump it full of all the things that I enjoy, like, you know, ancient civilizations and mysterious artifacts and sword fights and, you know, snark and wit and you know, just I really wanted to write just something that was fun, because I just think books, I think first and foremost, I mean, books can be many things, obviously, but I think first and foremost, they should be fun. Like, when I read, I want to be entertained. Yeah, I want to be absolutely gripped, you know, and, you know, if a book can inform and it can educate and it can sort of get across a powerful message as well, and that's obviously terrific. But I just, first and foremost, I want to be entertained. And so I really wanted to write something that that did that, that kind of was a page turner that people just kind of felt gripped by and really entertained by. And so far, like, just based on kind of the reviews that I've seen, it does seem that people have really, you know, enjoyed it. But I've also picked up on that kind of, like, the fact that I've seen quite a few comments of people saying, oh, I burned this in 3 days. And I just think that is just so gratifying to hear, because that's exactly the kind of thing I hope for. I really wanted to write a sort of a ripping yarn that people could just smash through really quickly. So to hear that, it just kind of really, you know, it just makes my day, really, because that's exactly kind of what I wanted to achieve with it. So
yeah, like, it sounds great. And reading the description, it definitely brought to my mind, like, some of my favorite books, like Loch Lomora and things like that. It seems to have that sort of vibe around it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned Liza Loch Lomora, because that was, I would say that was probably my main influence writing it. I think reading Liza Loch Lomora when it came out in 2006 just kind of blew my mind, because I think at the time it just felt so different to all the other fantasy that was around. And it really opened my eyes, I think, at that point, and made me realize, oh wow, you can actually do other things with fantasy rather than just like the hero on a quest kind of thing. It just felt so different. And also at the same time, you had The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie come out in the same year, which was like one incredible year that was. But and that, obviously, while Joe's kind of work does sort of take more traditional kind of tropes, at the same time, the way he kind of played around with them and the kind of aesthetic that he had and the kind of the really dark humor that he kind of put in and really pushed to the front as well, those books are really funny, you know. And again, that wasn't something I'd really seen in fantasy before. So both Liza Loch Lomora and Blade Itself, both just really funny at times. And that felt quite unusual, because a lot of the fantasy I grew up reading, like Terry Brooks and Robert Jordan and Tad Williams, quite and you know faced. Like, it didn't, not to say that it took itself seriously, but it certainly didn't have humor of that kind of level in. So that again was just a bit of an eye-opener in terms of what you could do with the form and the genre. So they were both very much kind of at the front of my mind when I was sort of writing this, and I very much set out wanting to write a book that, you know, kind of captured the same kind of wit and energy, and just like, particularly in the case of Liza Loch Lomora, that kind of just really vivid sense of place, you know. I feel like the world building in that and the sense of place is just so strong, and I really wanted to try, and I just remember thinking to myself, if I could write something half as good as that, I feel like I would have succeeded in doing what I want to do. I actually got a quote from Scott Lynch the other day, which was the book, which was just, I think my spirit like temporarily left my body, you know. It's just like, it's just surreal, like, because I'm such a fan, and I don't think Scott tends to quote that much, so to get a quote from him and knowing that he'd read the book and had enjoyed it was just like, it was one of those moments when you kind of feel like, oh, I've actually done this, I've kind of set out what I wanted to do, you know. That was a really gratifying moment. That
so what we're saying is that Tarek needs to finally read Lies of Loch Lomora.
This is the push I needed. This is it.
But yeah, Tarek, you're a crime writer, right? Like, Liza Loch Lomora is a kind of a crime caper novel. So
I know Marco's been, pushing me to read this book for about, since as long as it came out, I think. So I do need to read it. It's on my list. I think I actually have it, the audiobook somewhere downloaded. So I need to actually do read it, because I've heard nothing but amazing things about it.
It's a good one.
It's fantastic.
But I wanted to ask you about your day job, because as you mentioned at the start, you are a commissioning editor for Orbit. And I wondered, how does that day job interplay with your writing? Because does having a job like that, where you're kind of hooked into the industry, does it help with the writing? Are you, you know, in terms of, you know, I'm not necessarily seeing trends, or but just getting an idea of what is out there, where there's a gap, maybe what you think works and what doesn't work, seeing a lot of writing?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's It's a really interesting question that I've thought about quite a lot, and considering how it may have sort of, you know, how it may have helped me. And I think the main answer to it is I think a lot of people might assume that you know, being in the industry already made it a lot easier to get a book deal, and I can very much assure you that's not the case. Like at the end of the day, you have to write a really, you know, a really good book that someone connects with and wants to buy. You know, obviously, being in the industry and having connections and things like that, it's like publishing is like any other industry. The more kind of connections you have, like, the more doors tend to open, and it's just the way it is. So you know, it doesn't matter how many connections you have. If you've written a rubbish book, no one's going to want it. You know, so it is all about the book ultimately, regardless of, like, you know, anything else. But I think where it benefited me was I had a sense of, well, firstly, sure, like, from a kind of an actual book point of view, you have a sense of what works and what doesn't, and you know, things like that. But I think really where it helped was I know how the industry works. I know that, like, I think a lot of the problems that arise in publishing are when kind of expectations are not kind of met. And it's normally kind of on the author's side, like, you know, they have high hopes or whatever, and then the book doesn't quite live up to that sort of level. So I think a lot of the editor's job is just trying to kind of make sure that everyone's expectations are kind of, like, on the right sort of appropriate kind of level, which isn't an easy thing to do. But I think, you know, what I'm saying is, because I'm in the industry, I have been able to kind of manage my own expectations, because I know that, you know, I know that a lot of things have to happen in order for a book to be successful. I know that there's so many different elements that need to come together. I know that things can go wrong. I know that really good books just sometimes don't get picked up. And I also know that books that maybe are not so good do get picked up and become massive. Like, you know, so I just sort of know the different things that can happen, and the things that can go wrong, and the things that can go right. And so it just meant that I was coming into this whole process very much with my eyes wide open, because I know how the industry works. I suppose one way it did help is coming back to the idea of, like, contacts and stuff. Obviously, been in the industry a long time, and it did mean that I had sort of certain contacts that just maybe made it a little bit easier. Like, I had probably one of the easiest kind of, I mean, obviously, writers come on here and they talk about, like, querying agents and things like that. And I must say I had, like, one of the easiest kind of, you know, agent query processes, like, you know, ever, I was just very fortunate, and one of my friends who, you know, worked in the industry as well, who's Anne Perry, she, you know, just around the time that I was finishing kind of, like, the sort of I don't even know what pass it was. I did so many passes on Silverblood, I forget, but fourth or fifth pass, you know, it was the final one that I was doing before I was thinking about querying agents. And I was actually just at the point where I was starting to think, okay, this would be around 2019, I think. And I was kind of like, right, I finally got this into a state where I feel like I'm ready to query agents. And at the exact same time, Anne just dropped me a line. She'd been on maternity leave, but she was coming back. And she just basically emailed me and said, hey, so, you know, obviously, I was previously working in my editorial role, but now I've decided that I want to change and I'm going to be an agent instead. And I know you're writing something, so, you know, do you want to send it to me? So, you know, so I was like, oh, you know, you're not going to say no, are you? So, yeah, sure, okay, fine. So I sent it to Anne, and you know, a few days later, she got back to me and said that she really loved it, and did I want to sign with her? And so I did. You know, so that was, you know. Well, I feel quite guilty when I think about some of the stories that people tell about how long it took them to get an agent, and how many rounds of submissions they had to do. And they just kind of think, gosh, I, like, literally didn't even have to do anything for it, you know? So I suppose that's an example of maybe how being sort of in the industry helped, but it certainly didn't help me with the next bit, you know, which was, you know, going out on submission. Before we did that, Anne did an edit on it and made me take out about 40,000 words. So that was, you know, bit of a killer moment, but now the book was so much better for it. And so anyway, we went out on sub around, I think it was around March 21, so we were kind of still in the pandemic years at this point. Not the best time to be going out, because you know, I think exhaustion had definitely, fatigue had definitely set in amongst, I think, many people by that point, you know. So it was a bit of a weird time to be going out. It was also a little tricky for me because we were going out at a time when I think publishers were very much starting to look for diverse, you know, voices and authors from underrepresented backgrounds. Because obviously, you know, fantasy in particular had been dominated by white men for so long, you know, so... there was a real move towards kind of more diverse voices, which is great and long overdue, but at the same time, not terribly helpful for me. You know, so it wasn't the easiest time to be going out, but you know, you can't do anything about that. You just have to roll with it. So yeah, we went out on sub and we were on sub for about 18 months and nothing happened really. No offers anyway came in. It's a hard thing actually. And this was a really valuable experience for me as an editor going out on submission like this, because it really gave me the firsthand experience of what it is like to be an author, to be out on submission. Now, it's something that editors just don't have. We don't have the experience of that, but I was getting the experience of it. And it was emotionally, it was tough. Like because you poured your heart and soul into this thing for like years in my case. And then you're excited to go out on sub and then you go out and it's nothing. It's just silence, you know, and it wasn't so bad for me because, as I said, managing expectations, I know that sometimes these things can take a long time, but at the same time, you also know that sometimes things get snapped up inside 24 hours or a month, you know, or sometimes you get a big preempt. So at the same time, I had that at the back of my mind as well. And you're kind of thinking, oh, what if? And then, of course, that didn't happen. And then the rejections slowly start coming in. And the early rejections we got were like really positive. They're like, this is really good. We really like it. It's just not quite what we want. But you're thinking, okay, that's fine. You know, like they didn't hate it. This is surely a good thing. The trouble is when you get to 6 months and 9 months and you get 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 rejections, they're all saying the same thing. We really liked it. It's just not what we want. That kind of goes from being a positive to just being quite frustrating because you realize that the problem is not the book. It's just not what the editors are looking for at the moment. So, you know, the book is good, but no one wants it. And that's a particular kind of disappointment, I think, and frustration. But we had some near misses, both in the UK and in the US. We had some both, you know, in both territories, we had some really, really solid interest that ultimately just kind of fizzled out and didn't go anywhere. It was... After 18 months of being on submission, like we kind of ran out of options. And so, you know, certainly, you know, my position in the industry hadn't really helped in that sense at all. Having said that, we did go out under a pseudonym because it was really important to me that like the book was picked up on its own merits and not because of, you know, the fact that it was me who wrote it. I still don't know whether that, you know, people knowing whether it was me, like whether that would have been a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. But I just preferred to kind of let the book try and speak for itself rather than influencing it in any one way. After 18 months, we had no deal. And at that point, you're kind of thinking, what do I do next? And I thought about writing something else, but I couldn't quite bring myself to do it because I'd spent so long on this book. But also I believed in it because of the rejections that we had. We'd all been so positive for the most part. I knew it was a good book. I didn't want to abandon it. So Anne said to me, well, why don't you self-publish it? So I thought about it for a bit and I thought, well, actually, it wasn't something I had really like ever thought about doing. But by this point, self-publishing has become such a massive thing. You know, I've watched it grow from when I entered the industry. It was just kind of still regarded as being like a vanity kind of press type thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, obviously, it's big business and a lot of self-published authors do really super well. And I know in particular, the kind of fantasy that I have written does very well in the kind of, you know, Kindle Unlimited and self-published world. So I kind of thought, well, you know, given that I have a lot of experience editorially speaking, I know how to write copy. I understand how to position something. I know how to write marketing copy. I felt like I had a pretty good chance to make a good fist of it. So I kind of thought, all right, I'll do it. I'll self-publish it. And it's not what I wanted to do, but I believe in this book and I don't want it to see it locked away in a, you know, digital trunk gathering dust. So I started down that path and I commissioned, you know, the artwork, which actually is the artwork that you see on the kind of final book, or will see on the final book. So I Googled artists and I found Jeff Brown, who is just terrific artist. And so because we got the cover art going and we kind of worked on that, and so I was moving towards kind of self-publishing it. And then Anne rang me up one day and basically said, I've got good news and bad news. The bad news is that I can't be your agent anymore because I'm leaving agenting. So you just think, oh wow, like, you know, after the kind of various hits I've taken on the submission kind of process, like to then lose your agent as well was felt pretty bad, you know. But then she then said in the next breath, however, I'm joining Joe Fletcher as editor, or, you know, as publisher actually, and I want to take your book on. I want to buy it, and, you know. So I just didn't register it at the time because it's just such a mind blowing thing to be told, and you know, those two things in the space of 30 seconds. So just kind of like my mind just went blank. I just think I mumbled something like, "Okay, well, yeah, I'll have to think about it," you know, which is obviously ridiculous because I put the phone down and was like, "What am I doing? Of course I'm going to say yes to this because we literally have no other options on the table." So yeah, you know, so obviously I said to what I phoned Anne back and was like, "Yeah, look, actually, of course I want to do this." So. Yeah, it then began a period, like kind of like a long-winded process of like waiting for Anne to take up the job, and then when she did, there was a million and one things for her to sort out. So it was another sort of 6 months before she was able to actually bring the book to acquisition. But she did in the end, and did manage to get it through acquisitions and bought the book. So it's quite a weird route into publishing, you know, to have your agent who, you know, sent the book out on submission for 18 months, then. You know, end up buying it themselves and, you know, publish it. It's quite a strange route that I've not sort of come across anyone else having. So that was a really quite strange experience, but also really exciting and very gratifying. But what was also just really gratifying was, you know, I said to Anne, I was like, you know, she said, well, obviously we can distribute the book in America. And I said, well, actually, do you think we could have another crack at maybe trying to sell it in America? Because, you know, by now we've got a much better manuscript. I've done more work on it since. Mm-hmm. We've got a stronger manuscript. We actually have a cover. And because, you know, Joe Fletcher, who obviously recently announced they're being renamed as Arcadia, because Arcadia loved the cover so much, they actually wanted to use it. So we had a cover and we had a better manuscript and we had a better title as well than the one we went out on sub with. So I just said, can we just try again, go out on sub in America and just see what happens? So we did. And this time it went to auction in America and we had two publishers both wanting it, which is amazing. You know, it's just so funny, isn't it? But yeah. I just think with publishing, one of the things I've really learned is that so much of it, I think, is about timing. And when I say like timing, what I mean is the right book at the right time in the right pair of hands. You know, that's kind of, if we talk about luck in the industry, I think that's what luck is. It's the right thing in the right hands at the right time. Those three things have to come together. And it was kind of amazing to me that pretty much the same book that was roundly rejected a year earlier suddenly had two publishers, quite large publishers, both kind of, you know, fighting over it and going to auction over it. And in the end, we did sell it, you know, six-figure deal to Tor, which, you know, was just a phenomenal situation to be in. Like, if you told me that 12 months earlier when we were sitting there with no offers on the table and I was looking at self-publishing, I just never have believed you that would have happened, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was really just quite an extraordinary turn of fortunate events, you know. When you think about all those little things that needed to happen in order for us to reach this point, it's really quite mind-blowing. But, that's how we've kind of, you know, ended up where we are now. And, you know, obviously being just like a month out from publication. So it's been a pretty wild ride. But I mean, to answer, that was a very long winded way of answering your original question of like, you know, how does it kind of sit along the day job and so on. But I think really I try to kind of keep them as separate as I can. You know, I try not to, it's like in Ghostbusters, you don't want to cross the streams, you know, like I try to sort of keep them separate. And you know, I think that's the best way of doing it. But it does mean that I spend most of my waking hours thinking about books one way or another. And there's far worse things you could be thinking about, right? You know,
And folk always say, you know, just being an editor, I mean, it's easier when you come to sell your book or stuff, etc. But is there an argument for the reverse, perhaps? You know, has writing a book impacted your day job in the sense of, you know, give you an understanding of an author's perspective, and has that influenced how you do your day job since writing the book?
Yeah, it certainly made me realize that the pressures that authors are under, and just the sheer amount of effort and hard work it takes to write a book and then go out and sub with it, and the emotional roller coaster that can be. I've had a firsthand experience of that. Now I like to think it's made me a much more kind of empathetic kind of editor and much more understanding of these pressures. And it certainly made me want to try and get to the submissions that I have to read like a lot quicker than maybe I have been doing. And just the industry is just so slow, and I mean editors have so much on our plates. Like, there are so many things that need doing, and we have so many submissions at one time, and particularly now that fantasy it's just kind of exploded with like the romantasy and cozy fantasy and all these kind of things. It's become massive and it's terrific, but it does mean that we are just deluged now. And I think, you know, years ago, like publishing, I don't know if it's this, maybe it's still the case in other genres, but I remember, like, you know, in the summer, it tended to quieten down a little bit. You know, people were on holiday, nothing really happened. Whereas now it's just like we get submissions every day, every week, all year round. So,
how many submissions are you dealing with then?
I mean, it can vary, but I mean, I think collectively as a team, we can easily have like sort of, 15 to 20 come in a week, you know, which might not sound like a lot, but they quickly add up, you know, and that suddenly becomes sort of like 60 to 80 a month or something. And when you think about the limited time that we have in which to read, like, no one really, we try to read during working hours, but like, there's so much else to do, like, and it always gets kind of shunted to your spare time, you know. And I think most editors do kind of read in their spare time, and it kind of replaces pleasure reading in a way. And I think reading for pleasure is one of the things you kind of have to give up a little bit when you move into publishing. I think it's a sacrifice we all kind of have to make to some, you know, it's rare that I kind of read for pleasure. And like, I will occasionally carve out time to do it when a book comes along that I really want to read, you know, but it's hard to do that. And it is hard to kind of fit it in. And that was before I even kind of, you know, started writing my own books, you know. So, I mean, I've actually dropped down to 4 days a week now to try and balance it a bit better, you know, which certainly has helped the writing side, but it's not necessarily helped the work side, because I have even less time to get everything done. So I've had to become really, really good at managing my time and really quite, you know, sort of strict with what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and when I'm doing it. So, but yeah, I like to, it's made me want to get to give people responses on submissions more quickly, because I know how much effort has gone into them and I know how hard it is waiting for news. I know how it feels to go months and months and just not hear anything. It's tough, you know. And I think, so I definitely think, to answer your question, I definitely feel like I've taken that on board, and I try to, you know, to remind myself of that. And when I see my list of submissions is going bigger and bigger, I'm just thinking, I've got to get back on these and, you know, not keep people waiting. So
yeah,
definitely something I've learned.
But I mean, I think it's interesting for people to hear that, because obviously we hear often about the number of queries that agents will get, but then there's obviously, it's perhaps less talked about, but there is this second wave, obviously, that you have to go through and submit your book to publishers. And if you think about that just in terms of numbers, 60 to 80 a month, say, and then there's only so many books that you can publish a year. So, you know, it is a very difficult process to go through in that thing.
It is. Like, I mean, it's a numbers game. And like, you know, even like sometimes, like, quite often you'll read something and you'll think, this is really good, but like, you just can't take it on because you have something else that's like very similar to it coming out at roughly the same time. Or, you know, you feel like it's really good, but it needs some work, and you just maybe don't have the bandwidth to do that work. And that's really hard to kind of, when you have to let things go because of that. But yeah, there's a lot of factors to take into consideration. But I mean, as many kind of like submissions as we get, like, obviously agents get even more, like, they have to kind of whittle them down. And they're the ones that are really on the front lines, like doing in the trenches, kind of having to fend off like the most of what we get is at least kind of like,
yeah, you know, it's curated, at least
it's of a certain quality most of the time. Whereas the stuff that agents have to go through is, obviously, they're on the front lines fending off all of the kind of you know, the other manuscripts as well that maybe aren't worth our time, unfortunately. So they just get huge numbers, and like, it's that. Really tough job for them as well. I think I think everyone, the sort of, when you talk to people in the industry, the one thing you take away is that everyone just has too much to do, you know. It's always been like that, and you just kind of have to find ways of making it work. But it is challenging. And I was kind of curious as to see kind of how I would feel like, you know, trying, how it would work for me balancing these two things, like the writing and the kind of editing day job alongside each other, and whether I would get kind of burned out on it. But I think the simple fact is, I just really love this stuff. I really love books, I really love fantasy and science fiction, and like, there's being surrounded by it all day, whether it's someone else's book or whether it's my work, like, I, you know, it just, as of yet, I've not, it's not burned me out. So I'm hoping that continues for a long time.
It's part of a series, obviously, the Silverberg Promise, part of the Last Legacy series, I think. And did you say you're working on the next one just now? Is that what you're working
on?
Yeah.
So I'm working on book two at the moment and sort of powering as quickly as I can towards the end. The first book is coming out next month, which is exciting. But at the same time, my deadline for book two, for handing book two in, was like also next month. So every time I was like, oh, this is cool, publication's coming around. And then you're like, oh, damn. So is the deadline for book two. And, so that's been an odd dynamic to work with. I've actually had the deadline extended by a couple of months because I just need a bit more time. Because I'm not the fastest writer. You know, I know some writers can smash the books out really quick, but I'm not like that, unfortunately. So I need a bit more time. But it's a series. My idea is kind of one of my starting points for the series was I wanted to write a series that had kind of an overarching storyline, but where each book was kind of as self-contained as it was possible to be, and also where each book would take place in a different setting, partly to stop myself from getting bored, but also to give the readers some, like, a new setting to kind of get their teeth into every time. And I just thought it was a really kind of fun way of keeping it interesting. Also, one of my friends, the writer, Mark Charon Newton, whose books came out quite a while ago, actually, now, about a decade ago or something. He wrote the Legends of the Red Sun series. The first book was Knights of Viljamur, which is terrific kind of dying world fantasy. But he wrote that whole series was set in kind of a dying earth where there's an ice age had descended on the world. And I remember him saying to me by the end of the fourth book, he was like, dude, I'm so bored about writing about snow. there's only so many ways you can describe it. Yeah, I didn't want to be in that position. I didn't want to get bored of writing what I was writing. So I just thought, let's try and have a new setting each book. And so hopefully Silverblood, while it starts off this kind of big story, at the same time, it does have a start, a middle, and end. It doesn't end on I suppose you could argue there's a slight cliffhanger there, but the actual self-contained story is resolved at the end of the book. And then if you want to leave it there, you can leave it there, and you've got kind of like, a whole story to some extent, or you can continue and kind of dive into the wider mystery. And so hopefully the second book is kind of following a similar formula. I think there's kind of like, again, it's kind of a self-contained story, but at the same time, it moves the overall story forwards. And I think at the end, I'm hoping that there's going to be big kind of payoff at the end this time. You'll get a lot of info about really what is going on, and it's the idea is that it'll set up the rest of the series. Then I think it's going to be a quartet, which is something my American publisher didn't realize when they bought it, and it was a slightly awkward moment when I was kind of like, yeah, I was like, you guys know it's four books, right? And there's like silence, and you're like, oh, but no, it's fine, they know now, so hopefully they'll, I've only got a three book deal, so I'm kind of hoping that we manage to get the deal for the fourth one. Yeah, so I was thinking like four or maybe even five, but I don't want to push my luck, so I'm going to try and wrap it up in four. But so that's the idea, is that the end of book two will set up books three and four. And I have a feeling they might be less kind of self-contained, maybe, because by that point the proper overarching story has really got going. And so in a way it's similar to, I think, what Scott Lynch is trying to do with his Gentleman Bastard series, where the first kind of, I think he said the first sort of, it's a seven book series, which is super ambitious, but I think he said the first three books are kind of like standalones, and then the fourth one is where
it kind of
sets up the story for the rest of the series.
The end of the third one kind of sets
up, doesn't it? Yeah, and I think book four is where it really, so it's almost like you have three standalones and then a quartet kind of. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a strange structure, but I kind of like it, and I think I'm trying to do something similar but on a smaller scale. I'm working away at that, and as I touched on earlier, it's been quite an interesting process, because obviously so different to the first time round, where I would just really struggle at times, whereas now I've got my process down, and I know what works for me and what doesn't. And I know that if I'm on the rare occasion when I sit down and it's not quite happening, I know to just walk away and just leave it, and I'll come back maybe half an hour later, or maybe I'll come back the next day, but whenever I do, it's always I'm back in the zone. Whereas with the first book, I would just kind of like double down, and if I was having a bad time of it, I'd be like, no, I've got to just double down and push through, and that just doesn't work. At least it doesn't work for me, and I'd end up sort of 5 hours in front of the screen and about 300 words to show for it, which is, now I know not to do that, so again, it's that process of learning what works for you and how to handle your own kind of various tendencies as a writer and just become more experienced. And so fortunately, writing the second book has been a lot smoother, but as I think Joe Abercrombie has said, that he has hated every single one of his books at some point during the writing, and I've definitely experienced that. Like, it's funny though, because with the first one, I never experienced imposter syndrome, because I suppose because there's no pressure, it's no one knows about it, it's your thing, you're just working away on it, and you don't really you don't really think about it other than that. Whereas with the second one, you think, now that you've got the book deal, you've done it once, you think you'd be more confident, but I found the reverse was true for me. And I'd have, there were many weeks when I'm just working on it, I'm just convinced it's rubbish. I'm just like, this is terrible. I'm going to just tank my career before it's even started. And, you know, and I really got imposter syndrome the second time round, even though I'd already done it once, which that does seem quite strange to me. But from listening to other authors talking, that does seem quite common actually. And quite frankly, if someone who's had as good a career as Joe Abercrombie has, if he's kind of has exactly the same experience, then, you know, I've just got to trust that this is a thing you go through, and you know, hopefully it'll all come out in the wash and it'll be all right in the end.
I think we've only had one guest that I can think of in 180 episodes that has said that they don't have imposter syndrome. I'm not going to say who it was.
Okay.
But yeah, there was one guest I think that denied it, but yeah, everyone else I think at certain times has that sort of feeling, definitely. But
it's funny because I do have a lot of confidence in my work, and I've always had that kind of confidence. I mean, I think maybe sometimes it's kind of strayed into overconfidence, but generally I manage to keep it on the right side of the line. But I'm always very confident in my ability and my ability to write good work. But at the same time, I still have massive doubts. And it's weird that those two things can coexist. But I think it's just part of the weirdness of being, I mean, being a writer is a weird profession anyway, because you spend so much time on your own in your own head. And it's a really weird thing to do anyway. But I think psychologically, it does lead you to some strange places. And to kind of be both really confident in your own ability, but also so doubtful of that same ability to turn it into something, it's really weird that those two things can coexist, but they do. And it's a strange place to be definitely. In, but you know, you just got to kind of muddle through. I've just learned that you've just got to keep going, keep moving forwards, and just try not to stop and think about it too much, because if you do, you just get lost. But
do you have, like, what I've, because I definitely experienced that as well, but what I find is if I can talk to someone about whatever this particular scene or whatever it is, even in the talking of it, out, it's often me just doing the talking, and I work it out in that discussion.
I've
verbalizing it and having someone else there to bounce it off somehow helps, rather than just sitting there and having it in
It does massively help. And my partner was subjected to, I mean, God, she, you know, we've been together the whole time I was writing the books. I started writing it about a year after we kind of, you know, got together. So she was there for the whole time. And my God, the amount of times she has just had to kind of talk me down from some proverbial ledge, but also the amount of times when I've sort of stomped, you know, this doesn't happen so much anymore, because as I said, I know what I'm doing now. I've got a grasp on my own processes. But back in the first book, the amount of times I just sort of storm into the kitchen, just, you know, throw something down and hurl something into the sink or whatever and be like, this bloody scene's not working. Then I just sort of rant at her for like 5 minutes, and then I just sort of like trail off, and then be like, and then she sort of look at me and go, what is it? And I'd be like, I've just thought of the answer, and I just turn around and run out again, you know, back to the computer and just frantically get it down before but that happens so much of the time. But I think, you know, it's incredibly valuable for me. I'm so grateful to have a partner who is also a writer and understands the creative process and just the mad places it drives you. And we're able to kind of bounce ideas off each other, but also we're like each other's support kind of network. And that I think that, writing is a really solitary profession, as we all know, but having someone to kind of prop you up and to bounce ideas off and so on is just incredibly useful. And I think a lot of writers maybe don't have that. And I'm super grateful to actually have that. I think it's really important.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Those were the main questions we had for you today. But as a regular listener, you'll know that we often ask our guests a few of the same questions, the first of which is, what was the last book that you read? And this is, I suppose, a difficult one for you. Last book that you read for pleasure, I suppose.
Yeah. I'm reading something on submission at the moment, which obviously I can't talk about, but I think it's quite exciting. So I have to see whether that actually goes anywhere. But I'm actually reading for pleasure right now, funnily enough, which is a rare occurrence. But I'm reading Empire of the Damned by Jay Kristoff at the moment, which is obviously the sequel to Empire of the Vampire, which I think I'm just a huge fan. I love Jay. Terrific. It's terrific. I'm a huge fan. I loved his Nevernight series. And this, I think, is even better. I just think Empire of the Vampire is just such a masterclass of modern fantasy writing. You know, I think just like the character, the plot, the pacing, the world building. It's the full package, I think. I think it's a great, if someone was kind of like relatively new to the genre, particularly as a writer, and they're kind of like wanting to know like really sort of what they should read, as you know, to kind of see how it's done, that I would definitely recommend that. I think there's just so much craft in it, you know. And to be honest, like, sorry, without wanting to turn this into a really long answer, I think at the moment, a lot of the books I see as an editor, I just feel there's like, without wanting to be snooty about it, I feel like there's a bit of a lack of craft at times. Like a lot of these books just seem to kind of run on vibes. And when you drill down on the plot, there's not really a lot there. Whereas for me, just personally, I'm all about character and plot. You know, I want kind of absorbing plots, and I want really convincing characters that you kind of want to, you know, that you just can't help but connect with. And I think I just think Jay Kristoff is so good at that. But also there's this real craft in that novel, in the sense that it has the two separate timelines. It also has a framing device, and it's almost like an oral history, you know. And I just think that setup is really interesting, but it's also really difficult to get right. And he's spoken at length about how hard the book was to write, and the fact that he almost quit at one point because it was just too challenging. And he also said how he couldn't have written this book 10 years ago because he didn't have the writing chops at the time. So I love the fact that he's really pushing himself. And actually, that's something that I would like to do as an author at some point, maybe when this series is done, if I'm in a position where I'm able to do another one, I would love to kind of maybe try and write something that really pushes the envelope a bit in terms of my own ability. But anyway, yeah, that's what I'm reading at the moment. It's terrific.
And what about the last film that you've watched?
Oh, I know you asked these questions, and I should have prepared for them. I think actually the last film we watched, I don't tend to watch many films these days. I don't know why. I just become much more of a TV person. But I think the last film we watched, actually, we rewatched June. Okay. We saw it at the cinema, and we sat right at the back, which was the worst place to sit, because we were right under the speaker or whatever. So you know, obviously, like in June, you've got those really loud moments. So all we got, like every time there was like an action sequence or a big dramatic moment, you just get this like foghorn of noise. But I also felt the mixing. I don't know if it was the film itself or whether it was just where we were sitting, but like you just get the foghorn of noise during the big moments. But then during the quiet moments, you couldn't hear what anyone was saying. They're just kind of whispering, and like so it was just. So we love the film. It was an incredible spectacle, but we came away kind of like not really knowing what anyone had said to each other. So we wanted to watch it again, and we did watch it again on the small screen, and I just thought it was terrific. I'm really excited for the second one. But yeah, so June was the last film I watched, I think.
Nice.
And what you said you watch more TV. What were you watching just now?
We just finished The Bear season 2. Oh, nice. Well, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's great. Like I watched the first season. I enjoyed it, but like I wasn't feeling it quite lived up to the hype I'd seen, which obviously isn't the show's fault, but I'd seen such great hype for it. And I watched the first season, I was like, oh, that's good. I liked it, but I'm not quite sure why people are going crazy for it. And then watched the second season, and I was like, right, this is why, you know, there's one. Oh, it's great. I love how I love how confident it is. Like confident writing will always win me over. And I love the fact, like without giving any spoilers, like there is a scene actually in the first season when it is just the main character, and you know, just I think he's at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and he's just talking like a monologue almost, for 5 minutes, and the camera just stays on him the whole time. It doesn't move around, and I think a less confident like director would maybe feel the need to show other people's reactions, pan across the screen or whatever, or across the set, but it just kept the camera on him for the whole 5 minutes, and it made it so much more powerful, which I just thought was really great directing and sort of filmmaking, as it were. But also like the episode in season 2, like again, no spoilers, but the Christmas episode when they're having the Christmas dinner, and oh my god, that was like, it was dense. It was just like, I felt like I was just having like an aneurysm the whole time. It was just just insanely tense, and I just thought that was superb. Like the writing, the scripting, the acting, the directing, the editing, it was really peak kind of TV. That was so I really really enjoyed that, and really hope that there's a third season at some point. So I think it's terrific. Yeah,
well, I just read they've got season 3 signed, and they're also doing season 4
back. Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Yeah, that's great news. Loved it. It's brilliant.
Well, the very last thing, as you know, we always do is a super quick fire either or. And I see there's no answer here apart from one, but I think I'm hoping you're keyed up enough to give me the right answer. But we'll get to that shortly.
Let's see.
So we'll start
off
with let's make you pick between the two writers who have given you their own advice or help in their own way, Scott Lynch or George R.R. Martin.
Oh man, that's tough. I mean, I do think I warn you, I'm not going to give short answers to these questions. I'm sorry. I'm the king of tangents. But to try and keep it very brief, I think George R. R. Martin obviously has just had so much flack from fans because of the delays to the books and stuff. But I think it distracts people from the fact that particularly those first three books in the Song of Ice and Fire are phenomenally good. Is it Storm of Swords? That is incredible. Honestly, that is as good as epic fantasy gets. But as much as I love those books, I think Scott's been more of an influence on my own work. So I think I'd probably have to go for Scott.
Nice one. TV or cinema? I think we know your answer to this one, probably.
I always wonder when you ask this question whether you mean like TV or film, or do you actually mean being at home and watching TV or actually being out in the cinema?
It's a good question. I've never really thought about it. I was
the cinema environment or the TV environment.
Okay.
But watching a film in either would be acceptable.
Yeah, I mean,
really?
I love...
That's not how I thought it, but anyway.
Okay. Are you going to do TV shows over or films?
So, I think so. I don't know, to be honest. It's something I read out.
if we're talking in terms of environment, I mean, I love watching stuff in the cinema, but I also just get so annoyed by people just not shutting up. So that just becomes increasingly a problem. So I kind of prefer to watch stuff at home on the small screen. But also, if we're talking kind of TV series versus films, I think also just TV, because I think as a medium for storytelling, I just think it offers more, and I find that more satisfying. So yeah,
nice. Night owl or early bird?
I'm definitely an early bird. Something I inherited from my parents, I think, is get up stupid early, and that's when I get all my writing done. So used to be a night owl. I used to stay up until like 1 a.m. writing when I was in my 20s, but I cannot do that now. If I'm up past 10, it's the next day's a write-off. So yeah, definitely early bird.
Music or no music when you're writing?
I always have something on. I can't write in silence. I actually find silence distracting, which people find really weird, but it's just, if it's really quiet, I get distracted by that. So I wrote almost the whole first draft of Silver Blood to the War on Drugs, Lost in the Dream album, which kind of ruined that album for me for about 3 years afterwards. But I don't know. I listened to that for a while, and then I kind of progressed onto listening to stuff that was just like mostly instrumental, so it didn't have lyrics in.
Yeah.
And then I went through a phase of just listening to, there's a great website called My Noise, and it has loads of ambient kind of noises like fireplace, rain on the roof, you know, dark alley, like whatever that sounds like, you know, all kind of manner of sounds. And so for a long time, until quite recently, I've been using that, because I find that really helpful, just having that kind of, like, helps kind of create an ambience, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm using that a lot. And then for some reason, more recently, I've just sort of pivoted away from that and started listening to just music again. So normally very loud things with loud guitars. So that's what I'm listening to at the moment anyway.
Nice.
And, always noise.
The final one, real book or ebook?
Oh, Tarek, I know this is the one. This is the one.
Break his heart is fine.
You know, I thought about my answer to this, and it's a bit of a complex one, but when I'm reading for pleasure, I tend to prefer physical, but I read a lot on submission, and having ebooks for submissions is like a game changer. I'm just about old enough. Yeah, well, I'm just about old enough to remember, like, when I first came into publishing sort of like 14 years ago, e-readers were only sort of just becoming sort of a thing, and e-books are only just becoming a thing. And so I was just about old enough to remember, like, printing off submissions to actually take home and read, which obviously is how the industry worked for decades, you know. That's just, you know, being able to just get something emailed to me and just forward it to my Kindle or whatever, is that's so much easier. And so all my submission reading is ebook. And I do like picking up, you know, the odd sort of ebook, the cheap ebook of something I've been wanting to read. And also, whenever I need to read through one of my own books, I've always, you know,
you're trying to appease Tarek. Really, your answer is real book.
I think as much as I do love physical books and I prefer to read them, I think I have to say ebook, because on the whole, I can't quite explain it, but let the guilt go, James.
I think just because
of their prevalence in my day-to-day working life and their usefulness, I think I have to just come down on the ebook side very slightly. Fantastic. But it's 51% 49%, just so you know.
Oh, that's fine. That 1%.
you'll take it, that's
1-0 in my books.
Dear. Thanks very much, that was a really great chat.
No, thank you for having me. It's been terrific to be on here, guys. Thanks so much.
Well, I mean, straight out the gate, strong first episode back, ebook choice. I have to say, I've always been a fan of James Logan and James Long. Does that count as two votes?
That's only one vote, I'm afraid. Only one. Okay. But yeah, this season, you're 1-0 up, which has probably never happened before.
And I think I'm going to stop here. I'm going to quit.
call it here. But yeah, thanks very much to James for coming on the podcast. That was a really interesting chat. And as I said at the start, you know, really interesting to hear from someone that has worked on the other side of the fence as well. And that doing that and going through the submission process will now, it sounds like, change his approach to how he deals with submissions as well. Because it can my understanding, I'm not there yet, but you know, it can be a very painful process, that, because you just don't hear anything for months from editors.
Oh, first of all, waiting, years or plus sometimes, exactly. You know, so it's interesting to see how being, like, it's not just a kind of one-way street, is it?
You know,
being an author, writing a book when you're a publisher, when you're an editor, is obviously helpful because you know the industry, but also vice versa when you're on your day job. It's nice to know that kind of feeds into and how you view other authors in your same position.
I think that's right. And you know, it's funny because often, you know, there's that whole painful search for an agent for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Can take a long time, and you probably think, yes, I've got an agent now, it's easy street. But no, it's essentially the same process with less control, almost.
Exactly. Because you don't do the letter, you can't tweet those first chapters anymore. It's in someone else's hands, and you just have to hope you pick the right person.
To take it on.
So yeah, it never ends.
It never ends. The pain of this show.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Pain's always there. But no, thank you, James Logan Long. That was an excellent chat. I hope everyone else found that very interesting.
Yeah, and the Silver Blood Promise is out next month, so I will definitely be picking it up, given its similarities.
Especially your Loch Lamora.
Yes. Next week, we've got another great guest.
Yeah, we're chatting with the wonderful Anthony Johnston, who I've called him Anthony. Is it Anthony? If
it's
there's no
Anthony.
H? It's Anthony, so the wonderful Anthony Johnston, and who's written, I mean, an absolute megaton worth of stuff, comics, graphic novels, books,
video games.
He wrote the comic The Coldest City, which was turned into Atomic Blonde, the movie with Charlize Theron. Another name I feel I'm saying wrong.
No, that's how I've always
Charlize
said
Theron,
it.
Charlize Theron, is how you would
say it? Maybe it's said differently, but I don't know.
He wrote Resident Evil Village, Dead Space, the original Dead Space he wrote, and The Dog Sitter Detective is his latest cozy crime.
That's strange, we talked to him about that. Yeah, he's written all these sort of horror things, action things, and his latest pivot is into cozy crime, which is, you know, we talked to him about why he's made that decision. It's a really interesting chat because he is someone that sort of, well, in his words, he feels that he got into writing, as in getting paid for writing, quite late. I say not, because it was when he was 30 or something. That seems that seems perfectly reasonable. But he's been pretty prolific since then in a whole variety of different fields, as you say. So yeah, it's a really interesting chat. So please do tune in for that one. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please do take the time to give us a rating and review on your favourite podcast app, as that always helps us to continue to get great guests on the podcast.
And if you want to get in touch, you can. This is a test now, if I can remember this bit, Marco. If you want to get in touch, you can do so by sending us an email to podcast@rightgear.co.uk, or you can find us online, where we are on pretty much every social media platform going, and some of the ones which I'm sure are not going any longer. Simply searching for @UKPageOne.
I'm just going to stop you there because don't bother with the other ones. Yes. If you can't find us under UKPageOne, then we're probably not active on that social media. Yeah. One thing is, I'm not going to be posting on every new social media platform that comes out anymore.
That seems fair.
Please do tune in for next week's episode because it is a good one. We're happy to be back, largely. Not been missing the editing, I have to say, but apart from that, happy to be chatting again. And we've got some great authors and other industry experts lined up for you. So we'll speak to you next week.
See you later.